solar has proven in those kinds of extreme weather circumstances and very hot weather and every point in between all around the globe, solar works. It's a solid state, very reliable technology. So when we talk about these kinds of temperature related events, solar is going to do just fine.
Hey there, solar warriors. I'm Nico Johnson, and this is Suncast. Each week, I pull back the veil on the life and business insights of clean tech entrepreneurs building the most noble and impactful companies of our time. I hope what you learn from this conversation is a catalyst for your own growth. So thanks for tuning in, and welcome to our tribe. Hey, welcome to Suncast, Solar Warriors. Thank you for tuning in. Welcome in if you're new to the show. I want to thank you for giving us the only non-renewable resource you've got. That's your time. I promise we'll take good care of it. And I want you to know that the investment you're making here is going to contribute to your advancement, not just in your job, your role, but in your company. If you're working for someone else, or if you're starting a business on your own, if you're just dabbling on the edges, am I an entrepreneur, an entrepreneur? I'm bringing to you the brightest minds on the front lines of the clean energy transition, so you can answer those questions. Am I really doing this right? What pieces am I missing? Today, to fill in some of those gaps, is a true industry OG, a pioneer in this sector. Kevin Christie has been in the solar industry more than 20 years. His work at Lightsource BP, as one of the largest IPPs in the solar industry, is leading to huge advancements in innovation for our industry. And I ask the question, in the world where we hear a lot of naysaying about the value of solar and wind and other renewables on the grid, a lot of folks, in light of Winter Storm Uri and other extreme weather events, want to make solar and wind the villain in the story rather than the hero. But the reality is that solar showed up in big ways to help lift the grid in Texas and other places. Not only that, but innovation in our sector is accelerating at a pace that we could have only dreamed of 20 years ago. Kevin and I get into that conversation specifically around how Lightsource BP and his team, as the head of innovation and operational excellence for Lightsource, are thinking about mitigating extreme weather events, about integrating things like AI into the project development process. How is digitalization, robotization, automation impacting the developer? And who better to talk about it than one of the industry pioneers around solar project development? We also welcome his colleague and the manager of innovation and operational excellence, Dave Martin, to the episode. You'll hear a vignette from Dave about halfway through this episode. So if you've been curious, how does a big time player like Lightsource BP think about integrating innovation and mitigating issues like hail, thinking about extreme weather events? How do they incorporate all of this learning? And how does that help the rest of the industry rise? How does it help us all enjoy greater prosperity and accelerate our clean energy transition? Today's Tactical Tuesday is for you. This is practical insights and guidance to help you thrive and grow in the clean energy sector. You can find more just like this in our more than 680 episodes here in the Suncast catalog at mysuncast.com or in whatever player you are viewing or listening on. Without further ado, let's get ready to tune up your skills, Solar Warrior, as we tune into another powerful conversation here on Suncast. I want to first introduce Kevin Christie, a true solar pioneer, been in the industry for many, many years. And Kevin is now head of innovation and operations excellence for the Americas at Lightsource BP. Kevin, great to have you on the show.
Thanks, Nico. It's great to finally be here.
Indeed. Finally is the operative word. We've been talking about having you on the show. We still have to do a deeper dive into your background so folks can really understand the OG part of you being a pioneer in this sector means. I mean, as I recall, you were, still at SunEd in the days when we started Suncast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I started in the industry in 2002. went to SunEdison in 2011 when SunEdison purchased a solar developer called Axia Power that Tim Derrick and I had co-founded and ran for several years. Mm-hmm. And you know, subsequently went on to Lightsource BP after the SunEdison bankruptcy.
Well, Lightsource is, you know, categorically a leader in the Americas and indeed globally as a not only a developer of renewable energy projects, but now an asset owner and operator. And as you and I have discussed at length offline, there is a lot of confusion in the marketplace around the relative, we'll call it, I'm going to do air quotes for those that are watching on YouTube, the relative worth of renewables to the grid. Some even postulate that renewables are in fact a liability to the grid. You pointed me to a USA Today article that we'll link to that, you know, didn't really speak favorably to renewables assets. And I thought it'd be really interesting to have the perspective and maybe the counter narrative in terms of how renewable energy assets truly are performing, especially in these scenarios of extreme weather events. And my understanding is Lightsource BP actually have quite a few assets down in Texas. I'd love to hear from your perspective, how does solar continue to operate in these conditions? What has been your on-the-ground experience specific to the Lightsource BP operating assets during extreme weather, like storm, hurricane, or winter storm Uri, for example?
Yeah. So February 2022, winter storm Uri came through Texas, the worst cold snap, you know, in recalled history, in Texas, and it caused a great deal of havoc, on the ERCOT grid, caused a significant number of outages, even unfortunately, a number of deaths, within the state. What's unfortunate about that event, aside from, you know, all the damage and loss that occurred during it, is there was an attempt to sort of spin the narrative about the difficulties that the ERCOT grid experienced. Well, this is because we've had this mad rush to put a whole bunch of wind and solar on our grid, and now you see what happens when you when you so recklessly pursue
the old "I told you so."
Yeah, it's the old "I told you so." Well, the truth about what caused the outages on the ERCOT grid was fundamentally that the natural gas distribution infrastructure on the Texas grid was insufficiently weatherized to be able to withstand those kinds of cold temperatures. And so they had valves and pumps, you know, that were freezing, and they couldn't deliver the natural gas to the gas burning plants. Some cases, the gas burning plants themselves were not weatherized. And so all of that plumbing that you sort of see, you know, on a gas plant, you know, they had the same kind of freezing events in those valves and fittings. And for the plants that were operating, there was a big effort to actually truck natural gas to the plants so that they could continue to operate and keep the grid up. At the same time, our first large solar plant in Texas, Impact Solar, which is up in the northeast corner of the state, by Paris, Texas, had an over 96% availability throughout the entire, you know, period of the crisis. There's a great on-the-ground team that was doing everything to, you know, clear temperature faults and such, but we achieved a very high level of uptime. And when the weather cleared, but it was still cold, we were putting out full capacity from basically 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. In the middle of the winter because there was snow on the ground. It was cool temperatures, which solar loves, lots of sunlight. And so we were delivering maximum energy to the grid at the time that it really needed it. So solar has proven in those kinds of extreme weather circumstances and very hot weather and every point in between all around the globe, solar works. It's a solid state, very reliable technology. And so when we talk about these kinds of temperature related events, solar is going to do just fine. You know, on the other hand, in the case of these very cold weather, extreme cold weather, the Texas grid just wasn't, you know, prepared for it. The natural gas distribution system wasn't prepared for it because they hadn't experienced, you know, those kinds of temperatures. Nothing was built in Texas to withstand that. Now I would want to reassure your listeners, they shouldn't rush to the conclusion that natural gas is an unreliable source of energy. Because with sufficient weatherization, natural gas as an energy source can be just as reliable as solar has proven itself to be. Just that, unfortunately, you know, the natural gas industry in Texas just had work to do to be able to get up to the standards of reliability that solar set.
The reality of these extreme weather events is that they actually move beyond, and so a more common scenario, certainly I grew up in the South, in rural South Carolina, farm town, very familiar with the kinds of what other regions might consider like freak storms, where, you know, golf ball size hail is falling out of the sky for seemingly no reason, which is a nightmare for any solar plant operator. Of course, we've got fields full of glass, despite the fact these panels are tested against exactly that, rather large hailstones, projectile, you know, shot at the module to ensure that they won't break and they won't stop functioning. These kinds of additional extreme weather events beyond just cold snaps are a more frequent and more common headache for an asset owner like Lightsource BP. You all have spent a lot of time in the area around real-time extreme weather information and project preparation to anticipate these kinds of events. And I'd like to hear, as an asset owner, how you think about, in particular, hail mitigation, the integration of asset tracking, like weather tracking, real-time extreme weather information, into your asset performance portfolio, how you think about and talk about it with your investors, and what benefits have come from your approach to extreme weather prevention.
Yeah, so just to set the stage, in 2020, the insurance market for solar assets, based on some significant losses in Texas with regard to hail and some other markets with respect to fire and flood, went from a sort of one deductible, all risks are covered kind of a contract to we're going to have a separate deductible and coverage limit for these separate categories of risks. Oh, wow. Hail, certainly being one of them, fire, flood, earthquake and such, for others. And what we found is that the deductible exposure for a hail loss was as much as, 5% of the total insured value of the asset, which, when I ran the numbers, was about a $14 million deductible exposure for us for, our largest solar asset. And then at the other side, they had a coverage limit that was low enough so that it would not fund the complete replacement of the field if that's, what we ultimately had to do. And so we went from the experience of insurance being like, the donut that surrounded the deductible hole to being, the hole that surrounded the coverage loss donut, right? Mm. Or that was inside the coverage loss donut.
Great way to visualize it.
So owners like us were just significantly more exposed. And so we had to become activists in our approach to managing that risk as best we could. Fortunately, all of our projects in the United States, and it's true of, most every utility scale asset, has a single access tracker, that's part of the system, so that, the modules are tracking from the east in the morning over to the west in the afternoon to sort of maximize their exposure to sunlight. Because, we have access to the tilt angle of those trackers, we can, in anticipation of the storm, move those trackers to their maximum angle with the hope that you'll be able to deflect, the majority energy of hailstone as it hits the module. Being ready is all, as you said, about being aware of the weather that's coming, because if you try to use a hail pad, as they're called, a hail sensor, to trigger, your tilt response, well, you're going to be too late because hail is already falling, on your array. And it can take, that's 5 minutes or more to get over into your full tilt angle. So we said we basically need to make sure that we're already at full tilt before the storm comes. And so all of this starts with a great free service that's provided by the National Weather Service. This is through their Storm Prevention Center in Lawrence, Kansas, I believe. They provide what they call a day one convective outlook that also extends out to day two and day three, with less resolution. But we're always every day looking at the day one and the day two convective outlook. And we're able in our system to map any sort of risk layers that the National Weather Service sort of predicts for thunderstorms. They have kind of a gradated risk level where it goes from like 5% risk of large hail to 15% risk to 25% risk to all kinds of hatched areas and, you know, watch out, you know, a big one's coming. And so we're able to map that against the locations of all of our projects. In fact, we were just looking this morning, as it turns out tomorrow, which would be the 14th of March, 8 of our projects are within the National Weather Service's predicted risk bands for large hail for tomorrow. So we're going to be looking. Then the next thing that we do is we look at the hourly forecast for all of those locations where the projects are at to see when the thunderstorms are predicted to come through. And basically, we make sure that at least an hour in advance of those thunderstorms, we're at full tilt. And we schedule an exit to go back into normal production at least an hour after those storms are predicted to go through. And so we schedule the tilts, and then we monitor on an ongoing basis to determine, do we need to go in earlier? Do we need to come out later?
I recently was reading about a project. I thought it was really clever. The fellow that wrote the article said, if we've done this right, nobody will hear about it. Well, it's my job to find out about it and tell people how it's working, called Project Whiskey Ball. Can you talk a bit about the what is this Project Whiskey Ball and why it matters?
So Project Whiskey Ball is just what I've been describing, right? We just gave it a project name because we needed to aggregate resources around it and, you know, give people a name through which to call it and understand it. And, and you know, we've sort of also shared all of the best practices that we picked up out in the industry. And I should mention, you know, before we toot our own horn too loudly, that there's been some other significant contributors, you know, to the same kind of effort. I would start with Dan Sugar and team over at Nextracker. Who, by the time that I reached out to them, they were already down the path in terms of figuring out how their tracker could be, you know, of best use to their customers in implementing this kind of protection. And they'd done some early testing, extremely useful. I'd also call out the team at VDE. It's an engineering firm who, in conjunction with the Wells Fargo technical team, invests a lot of tax equity into these kinds of projects, ours and others, that they put together a best practices document, released it out to industry maybe 2-3 weeks ago. The excellent resource.
Mid-February.
Yeah.
It was a Valentine gift from VDE.
Just an excellent resource for developers and asset owners to be able to use to make sure that, you know, they put those kinds of preparations in place, whether they do it exactly the way that we do it or anybody else does it. The whole point is just when the hailstorm comes, have your modules at full tilt. That's and whatever path you certainly get there, you know, you've done it right.
And I really appreciate that, the nod both to the folks at VDE and Wells Fargo and Nextracker, who along with Lightsource BP are doing best in class work that really kind of open sources the community thought share around how this should be done, which is by definition what best practices really are. And we'll link to some of those resources that you've mentioned, in particular the technical memorandum from VDE. You mentioned a moment ago that one of the key drivers for you all is the outsized risk that the insuring of these products creates for you. What is some of the work that you've done to help drive down those costs, improve the risk analysis, any innovative products that have come out of that you've helped drive into the market?
Yeah, so I think there's two other organizations I could call out. First, Brown & Brown are our insurance consultants. And they early on sort of grabbed a hold of the work that we were doing and made sure that all of the various insurance companies that they work with, the ones that, you know, are part of the consortiums that insure our project, our different projects, that they were not just aware of what we were doing, but that we were, you know, pushing along with others all of those best practices out in the industry, because insurance is all about the pool of risk. We are able to get some, you know, concessions because we've, you know, we're an early pioneer in this, and You know, we provide this protection on 100% of our projects, regardless of where they're located in the United States. We don't sort of risk discount for, you know, from a resourcing perspective. It's just, if it shows up on the risk map in the United States, we're putting the plant into stow, right? So we ensured that we have that capability across 100% of our fleet. So that means something. But what we really need is, you know, the rising tide to lift all boats and really have the asset owner community and the developer community, first of all, make sure they specify projects that have this capability. And then the asset owner community needs to make sure that they have a program in place, you know, that is basically 365 days a year doing these risk assessments. And ideally have, you know, some kind of plan A, plan B, plan C sort of approach to this risk so that if plan A fails, you've got to roll over to plan B and to plan B, et cetera.
So I'm sure that folks who are doing exactly the same job that you're doing are nodding their heads. But for those who maybe have less experience at this level of asset performance, you know, you mentioned, I've heard you say before, what's bad for one is bad for all. And I can totally understand why if we all swim in the same risk pool, this makes a lot of sense for you guys, not only to you know, spend capital on, but to help socialize the concept. But how does a Brown and Brown, for example, as an insurance consultant, help to communicate what's happening? What's the value of a consultant like that in the sort of in the communication stream?
Well, I think they're keeping track through the insurance community of all the various events that are happening. Mm-hmm. And, you know, without giving close biographical details on each one, they're able to share, like, it was this plant that was in construction. You know, what you'll often see on a plant during construction is they'll just steal all the modules flat, you know, while they're installing them. You know, early on in our program, for instance, we changed, you know, an exhibit in all of our EPC agreements so that once they install the modules, onto the rows, they move them manually into hail stow and lock them. Right. So
that's really, I never considered that.
Yeah. So that it has been the experience in the industry that a number of the projects that have been damaged during construction before the trackers were actually operational. Right. Or if they were operational, they weren't yet in the care, custody, and control of the asset owner. And so, as I said, we have been able to achieve some concessions in our various insurance organizations. I think as different underwriters increasingly appreciate, you know, the value of having a program in place versus not having one in place. But I think it's really upon us, you know, the asset owner community, to demonstrate over time that when these storms come through, that the system was in stow. You've got the data to show it. And you've got the data to show that, you know, you suffered this level of damage or did not suffer damage, for instance. We've yet in the United States to have any reportable hail damage on any of our projects. I think that's largely because we've been fortunate enough not to have, you know, significant severe-sized hail strike any of our sites. But it really does make a difference whether or not you're in stow. It's just physics. Right. So if a 2.5-inch hailstone is coming straight down at your module, if it's flat, it's going to destroy it. If it's at a significant enough degree of tilt, it can survive it without damage.
Yeah. You mentioned that you had two and you brought in Brown and Brown. Are there other resources that you see in the marketplace where folks can look for additional insights, data sets, et cetera?
Yeah, I would also point to the folks at KWH Analytics, who I think, you know, with their sort of insurtech approach, has been able to not just, you know, show some underlying analytics about, you know, how does solar plants experience wind events during a hailstorm. What we found is that wind can be highly unpredictable. KWH Analytics has sort of confirmed this, is that during a hailstorm, the direction and wind speed can go all over the map just because of the dynamics of a thunderstorm. So that sort of settled the question of when you go into stow, do you stow into the direction of the storm? Do you stow away from the direction of the storm? Mm. You know, you just need to get into stow. And sort of luck will determine whether, you know, east or west was the best direction to stow into. But they also have been assembling products around, I don't want to say so much hail risk, but they've been able to develop projects or products that sort of can reduce the exposure of the asset owner to variations in solar resource.
They've been extremely innovative around the financial products that are able to be wrapped into solar projects. They famously introduced the solar put, solar revenue put. We'll link to Alex Deng does a lot of talking on that topic. So we'll link to some of those things if folks are unfamiliar with them. But ultimately, as an asset owner and as an industry, we're sort of taking the baton from the fossil fuel industry to carry our grid forward into a more clean energy future. And as has been the case in the past, the name of the game is really drive costs down as much as possible. And I think folks naturally ask the question, at what point does innovation for innovation's sake start to really increase costs? And Latitude Media did an article that I think is a great reference called Better, Faster, Cheaper, Safer. And it talks about how developers are experimenting with automation and software to streamline the work that's being done. I'd love to hear, are we hitting the natural limits within the given set of techniques and technology that we've used? Does this deploy? At what point does innovation start to take a side seat to just getting stuff out in the field? You guys have done, you're the head of innovation. So you've got a lot of thinking around how innovation gets done inside of a big organization. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, we never do innovation for innovation's sake. You know, we're not technicians that are sort of dreaming stuff up in a lab. We're trying to, on the one hand, sort of influence the industry from an investment standpoint, from a technological development standpoint, as sort of the voice of the developer, owner, asset operator. But we're also sort of leaning forward into some of the newer technological developments to test them out on our projects, partner up with, you know, early stage companies to try to prove out these technologies, because I do believe, and thanks for mentioning that Latitude Media article. By the way, Better, Faster, Cheaper, Safer is actually the slogan of our team internally. So we're,
oh wow,
yeah, it's the filter that we sort of view things through, right? So will this make it better, faster, cheaper, safer? Any two or more of those on the list? Because that's effectively what innovation does. And I think you can express it as choosing one of two different perspectives, right? And I think that Jenny Chase in that article sort of spoke very succinctly to one perspective, which is that solar should be dumb and cheap. Not that it should be dumb, but, it's cheap. And that's what's important. Deploy it, deploy cheap solar at scale. You don't have to get into fancy, robotics and artificial intelligence technologies, because solar has already sort of cleared the bar. Don't get distracted.
Right.
Deploy. But what we've been seeing, and I think it was pretty obvious in all the supply chain disruptions and the inflation, that we've experienced, not just in raw materials, but finished materials and labor, and particularly labor, right? If you're not looking for ways to reduce your material content, to shorten your supply chains, to reduce the weight of the volume that you're shipping, and to cut your labor costs, then that cheap solar is actually going to get more expensive for a variety of reasons. It takes longer to construct with higher interest rates. You spend more on interest-bearing construction. And so even if the CapEx doesn't change, even if labor rates didn't change, if it takes longer to install because you have to wait longer for things, then you're going to pay more interest during, that construction period, which is not an insignificant, driver of cost, right?
Right.
But it's also true, once the project's built, you're in operations. If you sum up all the anticipated expenditure on these projects over like a 30 plus year life period, what you're going to find is that 80% of those costs, it's just labor. And that's labor inflated like a 2.5% average inflation rate, right? Which that might have been true for like the previous 20 years when, money was basically free. It's not going to be true, in a world of new higher interest rates, right? So I expect that 80% might be more like 85% or more unless we change the way that these projects are operated. And the most effective way to change the way these projects are operated is to actually change the way that they're built. And so we think that there's a ton of room for innovation, I would say, in particularly what we call automation and digitalization. So automation is basically using an automated process in the place of what's a manual process. And so one example would be, if anybody's looked at how a solar plant is constructed, the first thing you do is drive a whole bunch of piles into the field. These steel I-beams or C-channels, right, that they pound into the ground, thousands and thousands of them, you know, on a large project. Well, there's companies like Built Robotics that are developing a bot that would do that autonomously. So they just have these racks, they fill the racks up with the piles, and then the bot will pick a pile up and then drive it into the ground, move to the next one, pick it up, drive it into the ground, you know, based on really accurate, you know, GPS landings, right? That's one example. Another company I could mention that's doing some really forward-thinking work on the automation space and construction is Terabase, led by Matt Campbell.
Mentioned in that article.
Yeah, Matt Campbell, former SunPower execs along with him. And they have developed a way to sort of pre-assemble or pre-mate a torque tube with, you know, a set of modules. Like if they're starting with first solar modules. So you get six first solar modules on a torque tube. So a robot arm picks the modules up out of the case, sticks them into an assembly area, pulls the torque tube in. There's just a couple of folks on the line
technicians
that make the mechanical attachments. And then that goes on to a robotic cart, basically, that will roll the torque tube out into the area of the array where it needs to be inserted, and it'll do the insertion and, you know, then come back and, you know, get the next one. And so they've been out there doing this on like a multi-megawatt basis for the last, I'd say, year or so. That saves a great deal of, it not just saves a great deal of time, but what it also does is when you have an automated process, you have a quality management process. And what is really difficult to do in the solar industry is to ensure that you have a consistent quality of construction when you're making, in some cases, millions of different mechanical connections with a whole bunch of workers who are not equally trained or equally conscientious, don't have equally calibrated tools. You end up with a lot of inconsistency in terms of mechanical connections, electrical connections. So the more that you can automate that process and monitor it, you know, through sensors and doing data acquisition and, you know, process optimization, that ultimately is how you sort of unleash this engine of capitalism called productivity, right?
Yeah.
And productivity is ultimately what drives costs down. It's just that the cost declines that we've experienced have all been in the factory. Because the factories have been doing this. They've been automating, they've been digitalizing, they've been optimizing their processes, getting to scale. And then you get all that stuff out into the construction field, and we're doing it all substantially the same way that we've been doing it for the last 20 years. So there's a huge frontier of potential for innovation on the construction side. And so imagine once you've delivered a project that has a significant degree of process control and quality control, now you have from the get-go a plant that is going to cost less to operate and maintain. And then as you can help technicians with the assistance of technology become more productive in their jobs, we can reduce the labor content during the operations and maintenance phase, because I can tell you what every O&M provider will tell you is there's not enough technicians. So this is not a case of robotics is going to come along and throw a whole bunch of people out of work. We need that automation just to keep pace with the fact that we're throwing more and more of this capacity on the grid. And, you know, we're not able to match that with a sufficient pool of, you know, trained and experienced talent.
I want to take a moment and really drill down on this topic of innovation and get specific. So I asked Kevin, who on the team actually on the ground sort of is your go-to manage the implementation that you just described? And He pointed me to Dave Martin. Dave is the manager of innovation and operational excellence for the Americas at Lightsource BP. And I wanted to get Dave's perspective on how his team is working on driving productivity at the ground level, bringing the operational efficiency out of the equipment factory, the supply side, and creating these factories in the field that our friends at Terabase are fans of promoting in terms of software, robotics, and getting to that terawatt scale deployment we're all anxious for. Dave, thank you for taking some time to join me for this conversation.
Thanks for having me, Nico.
We've heard it said, it's the famous iron triangle. I can give it to you cheap, fast, or good. Pick which two you'd like. So traditionally, innovation is seen as technological. I'd love to hear how Lightsource is thinking outside of that hardware aspect and drive efficiency and operational excellence into the assets themselves. And, is it still true that we can only have it? We can pick two, cheap, fast, or good.
Hopefully not. We're trying to overcome that. Like you said, leaving the hardware side where it is for the moment, what we're focused on is actually ensuring that we capture the value from these technologies and not necessarily, you know, if you have a robot like that can, you know, drive piles or build a site or monitor a site, that's great. You don't need to be an expert in robotics to understand what it's doing. What you do need to understand is what value that tool is giving you and what you're going to do with that performance that's going to make you better. Is it going to save you a dollar? Is it going to make you a new dollar? Is it going to give you something that's harder to value, like it will lower fire risk on your site, which maybe you capture that insurance, or maybe you just sleep better knowing that you have a lower fire risk at your site? Those are the things that we're thinking around in terms of how are we capturing that value, but then also what does adoption mean for our organization? So that could be, do we have to hire an administrator for this tool? Is the vendor managing this tool? What are the rules of operation? What are the safety implications? You know, we want to make sure an autonomous vehicle isn't bumping into stuff. Can it play well with sheep is a question that we've asked more than once in our organization. So there's so many questions. Once you figure out if a widget works and someone says, we want to put it in the whole portfolio, that just opens up 50 more questions that need to be run down and answered before you actually start getting that ROI.
In the areas of focus, external, internal, looking at business process, would you be able to give us some concrete examples of ways that you're seeing things come out of the lab or even from other domains of expertise and getting actually applied in the field on your assets?
The external lens that we use is really things that Lightsource can't implement ourselves, but that what we want to see in our final products. So automation of construction or automated monitoring of construction isn't necessarily something we can do independently, but as an end customer, we can start to pull that universe towards us and say, hey, we want these things to be implemented in the sites that we're building, or we want these materials used in the sites that we're building because we have a conviction that it's going to get a better result for us. It's going to build a better site. It's going to be better quality. Kevin talked about automated quality, knowing that those, you know, hundreds of thousands of bolts have been looked at and verified, or MC4 connectors. Again, that's, we don't build the site, but we can start pulling things towards us. Another one that Kevin and I have seen a number of times is anti-soiling coatings or different anti-reflective coatings for modules. Well, Kevin and I don't go out there with a roller and a brush and start brushing it on the 800,000 modules we have on a site. Yeah. But we could reach out to our vendors and say, hey, we're really interested in this. It'd be great if it was applied in the factory, and we'd be interested in paying, you know, X cents extra for this. And that's a way that all of a sudden a vendor is saying, hey, a big player is interested in this and knows that they might be willing to pay for it. That's how we can kind of throw that influence around.
I mean, I've often heard of the, you know, anti-soiling coatings. Are things like that making their way into the marketplace now, thanks to this kind of pull through?
I think a lot of vendors are looking at a lot of possibilities. So there are physical alterations to glass that some vendors are looking at, where they're saying, hey, if you laser etch glass a certain way, it actually affects the way that water holds onto it and it can roll off faster, or it can pull debris off.
Makes sense.
There's some electrostatic options that are essentially, you know, make it make the module dust. The dust doesn't want to cling to it. Repels dust.
Yeah.
And then there's obviously the Rain-X method, which is, yeah, you know, you wipe something on, it makes a little occlusive layer, and it just comes off in the rain. There, it's going to be on the market. How it's being approached is, you know, lots of different ways and at different scales, and how do you know, how does a factory implement that process? What Kevin and I have looked at is, can we participate in small scale trials, put it on some modules, and see if there's a difference in performance where we can then validate, you know, something that might have been done on a benchtop.
Everybody talks about AI these days. So I would love to hear, as a major clean energy IPP, how is AI finding its way into your portfolio management or even the development process?
Sure. So at Lightsource, we have actually a director of digital product and applied AI who is running a bunch of internal AI related work streams. So that could be around things like really fine tuning energy forecasting. I mean, if you think about, just to back up, if you think about AI generally, the whole concept is you feed a bunch of data to it and it tells you things that you couldn't have seen kind of with the naked eye if you were just scrolling through these large scale data sets. And what we find is, you know, a solar project and a solar company generates an amazing amount of data in terms of real-time performance, weather data, and then beyond internal data, things like permits or designs that we're making that could be correlated in new ways. So our internal team is working on products such as using large language models to search through our internal documents just to make finding that document that you need a little bit easier, which saves a lot of sanity internally. And then also using it for big data applications in terms of really fine-tuning generation or performance, being able to say, hey, there's actually a small pattern in losses across the portfolio that we could pinpoint and investigate and make more power if we could remedy it. So those are direct applications internally. And then we have had an amazing amount of incoming from AI vendors, which could be,
I can only imagine,
it's a huge umbrella of, you know, you give us all this data and we'll clean it up for you and we'll give you some insight, or down to really fine tuning things like, you know, we're going to use AI to search through RFPs, or we're going to use AI to go through all the different state policies on who wants solar. And we can, you know, give you a magic eight ball that's going to tell you where the next big market's going to be. It's all interesting, but again, it comes down to those questions of, you know, do we have to upload our data? Is it just a tool for information? Do we have to administrate it, or are you just going to give me a magic one pager that's going to tell us the future? You know, those are all questions to be answered. And obviously, you know, as everyone can see from the news, and at, you know, Kevin and I are on the forefront of it, is there's so many companies coming up with so many products that sorting through them, we might need an AI just to sort through all the AI opportunities that's we have.
Apropos. And with reason, you've got a head of digital to be responsible for helping sort through that data. You know, Dave, I often will ask what needed to be true for this to be possible. And so when we think about AI, a lot of folks have been talking for a decade about how when this, then that's kind of like our own sort of mental algorithm. What's been missing up to now that has become feasible to help us integrate AI?
One of the main drivers is just this proliferation of different models coming out for AI, and a lowering of the wall or a lowering of the bar to entry in the market. And what we're seeing coming from that in terms of large language models or just pattern recognition, or also probably just there's more people who understand it. There's more people graduating college with degrees in AI who have thought about it and studied it for a long time. But that proliferation or that easing of access to AI has really helped companies come in with new strategies. They'll take a technology and apply it to a niche area that really drives a lot of value for end customers, rather than a kind of general, you know, the famous thing with ChatGPT is you can write an email with it, or it's combing through a lot of different text, and you can make it generate a story or something like that. What we're seeing are really kind of surgical and precise applications of AI in a way that drive higher value. And the commercial example I give a lot is around the Nest thermostat, which is, here's a thing that you install in your house. It looks at your usage for your HVAC, and it'll make changes that you don't notice and change money and save you money. So, you know, install, use it a bit, and it saves you money and you forget about it. That's, in my opinion, a perfect niche application of AI. And we see that coming into our industry in a couple ways. One of which would be, we've worked with Thomson Reuters Document Intelligence, which is a contract reviewing AI. And the nice thing about that is they're training those models on legal documents, on energy related documents. It helps that they're not scanning Facebook posts when we're looking for PPA terminology. So that specific application has been able to allow us to structure data and find it more easily because it's a purpose-built, not just legal product, but energy product. Another great example is the folks over at OnSite are building a robot that's using, it's monitoring site conditions, looking at things like MC4s and modules, both visually and with a thermal camera. And what that is well on its way of doing is identifying specific types of failures and specific risks in a way that you can look at your site and say, you know, you have 500,000 MC4s on this site, and we know that these maybe 10,000 are at a high risk of failure, not just because of we've looked at every single one on your site, which a human, we would never have a human do, but also, you know, as they look at more sites, they could say in the entire universe of these connectors, these are the ones that we know are bad. So that value only compounds. And, you know, paying a person to walk around with a FLIR camera and do that, we would never even dream of doing it. And it's going to make, through automation and then machine learning and computer vision, it's just going to make every site that much better, that much more resilient.
Well, as we round out the conversation here, I wanted to think a little bit more about where this is all going. Kevin, you and your team, Dave, who we've just heard from, and the wonderful folks at LightSource are really ahead of the curve in many ways. You have peers running alongside you, but you have a view into, as Dave insinuated, you have a view into what's coming down the pike, and you see a lot of folks sort of inbound to you. What do you see as the future of innovation for solar? And I would say, let's add energy storage. I know that you guys have a number of assets that have incorporated energy storage, and potentially there are other areas that I'm not yet privy to.
Yeah, great. Well, I think on the energy storage front, it would be any number of hosts of different episodes about alternate chemistries, you know, for batteries, non-battery storage technologies. You know, we're going to see a significant amount of advancement in all of these things. And LightSource will hopefully be leading the way in terms of being able to help providers bring those to market and get them on our projects. I'd say, you know, more narrowly with respect to solar, it is really those two buckets that we think are going to reap the most rewards, and that is automation and digitalization, both, you know, in construction and in operations. And I should not hesitate to add, going all the way back to the design phase, right? So the sort of ideal concept is we start with a highly automated design and layout function that creates essentially down to the module level, a digital twin of what will ultimately go into construction. And then when construction starts, we have companies like Terabase, Drone Deploy, others that that will monitor that construction through flyover drones and be able to use machine vision to say, okay, this is your construction progress. And, you know, this, these things that are being built on there don't meet with the as-built. And so, you know, you modify the digital twin so that it matches what was actually installed on the site. So that by the time that you have, you know, a site that is fully constructed, you have an as-built that matches your, what's actually been installed in the field, which, you know, you might be surprised to find out is very often not the case. They just don't keep the good enough records. And, you know, you have a whole other piece of equipment inside of your substation that's not on your as-built drawings, for instance. So, and then between those two points, increasing use of automation in the actual methods of construction. And then as you get into the operation stage, I think there is great potential for, as we mentioned, things like the on-site bot to be able to regularly do machine inspections of your plant and to be able to create a geotagged history of everything that it's seen on the site. On the digitalization front, I'm thinking increasing interconnectivity between the various partners, you know, that are all needed in order to implement these projects. Everything from being able to be connected to your supply chain's digital system so that you know where your product is in the supply chain as it works its way toward your site, to being able to track through interconnectivity to the EPC's project management system all of the corrective measures that might be identified on a site. So you can say the EPC, you know, said they're going to fix these things, and you know, this is what was fixed, and this is what the fix looked like, and we have pictures before and after, you know, that are part of the digital history of the plant. And then as we get into operations, I can certainly foresee that at some point when a technician walks up to an inverter cabinet and opens the doors, they have augmented reality safety goggles that are able to walk them through the repair or the diagnostics that, that need to happen and actually record the serial number of parts as they come out and new parts as they go in. That kind of, you know, data-rich environment enables what I talked about in terms of process optimization, which is really where we need to get in order to be able to really drive costs down and performance up at the same time, sort of breaking that iron triangle.
I love that, bringing it back to the iron triangle. You know, one of the things that you have pointed out in prior conversations is the relatively short time horizon that solar and wind have in terms of making up ground on the 100-year-old power infrastructure that we currently enjoy. And we're not really on a linear path in terms of technological evolution. How, tying this back to sort of unlocking productivity, how do you think about that? As someone who's been in the industry for more than 20 years, the technological innovation we're seeing in such a short time frame, and what that really unlocks for us in terms of human capital.
Yeah, I think there's a huge amount of latent value. And I think it's because we're kind of trapped in a cultural loop. We've been rightly focused on deploy, deploy, deploy. But that deploy, deploy, deploy mentality has our focus much more narrow, which is really like, how do I get this thing to COD? You know, because money has to fund, you know, the crank has to be turned, goals have to be met. And that all contributes to an increasing amount of solar on the grid. But there are thousands of opportunities for pulling value out of not just, you know, new systems, but the systems that have already been deployed, right? So all of the 100 gigawatt, whatever, you know, we have installed in the United States, that's all latent capacity for new technology still. Not even just on the new stuff. So I think the next 20 years are going to be an opportunity for technological innovation in the same way that the last 20 years have been, you know, the opportunity for hitting deployment at scale. Sort of to put a bow on it, when we talk about automation and digitalization and what does that really hold in store for us? It's all about creating prosperity through increasing productivity. So if we can take the labor and material inputs that we have for a solar plant and figure out how to do more with them, all of those materials and people will become more valuable. Solar workers, as they're able to implement more work, more megawatts per worker, those workers will earn more money. And the overall prosperity of the economy will increase. This is economics 101. Right. And the decrease in cost of data acquisition, data storage, data analytics, the decrease in cost of automation and robotics means that all of us who work in the solar industry will become more productive and pick up bigger paychecks. That's economics 101.
Kevin Christie is head of innovation and operational excellence for the Americas at Lightsource BP. Kevin, it's been fantastic from my perspective, having known you for quite a long time, to sit at your feet and get a few lessons on not only the economics of solar, but set some of the records straight on how our assets are performing, and in many cases outperforming in the marketplace, in light of the fact that we do experience extreme weather and we are integrating increased innovation around the digital infrastructure required, as you put it, to help us all enter into a more prosperous and higher wage earning season in this industry. May it be so. Thank you for joining us here on Suncast.
Thanks for having me, Nico. And thanks to Suncast and the role that you guys have played for almost a decade now in telling the solar story.
Thank you for listening through to this episode. If you'd like to drill into some of the things that we talked about, if you'd like to learn more about what this innovation actually looks like, well, you're in luck because the Lightsource team has created a whole page around innovation and operational excellence. We'll link to it in the show notes. You can find it at lightsourcebp.com/us/about/innovation. And if that's too long, again, it's in the show notes in whatever app you're listening to this on. It'll be over at mysuncast.com on the episodes page as well, which we'll link to. If you go to that page, you can read all about hail mitigation, AI-driven contract insights, pilots and early deployments, and all the case studies that Dave and others have written around how they are, in fact, mapping our way to a more resilient future, to steal their exact words from one of their case studies. Thank you for sticking around. If you've listened this far, I would like to ask for 3 more minutes of your time. If this was meaningful to you, I'd like to ask you to do one of 2 things. Either hop on LinkedIn and thank Dave and Kevin for contributing to your knowledge and education. The easiest way to do that is to find the LinkedIn post that we have put up for this episode and leave a comment for them. Connect with them. I know that they both are active and ready to hear from you. The other way is go to ratethispodcast.com/suncast and leave us a 5-star rating and enthusiastic review so that others like you on the front lines of the energy transition can find our content and grow just like you have today. And if you'd like to just the old-fashioned way reach out to me, you can do that at nico@mysuncast.com. I love hearing from you. Make sure in the subject line you put something like feedback from Kevin Christie's episode so that I'll know exactly who you are and it won't go into spam, hopefully. I'm so grateful for all who give their time, not only to contribute to creating this content, but listening to it and putting it out into the world in the form of real action. That is you. Go forth and prosper. Remember, you are what you listen to. Thanks again for showing up, Solar Warrior. It's half the battle.